Notes from the Left Forum in New York City. Rage, rebellion, organizing our power was the theme of the conference, where panelists discussed revolutionary alternatives to contemporary capitalism. Tariq Ali is a British-Pakistani writer, journalist, and filmmaker. He's a member of the editorial committee of the New Left Review, editorial director of London's publishing house Verso, and author of many books, the latest, The Extreme Center, A Warning. At the Left Forum plenary entitled Capitalism and Militarism at Humanity's Peril, Organizing Our Power, Ali began by speaking about how we are witnessing the radicalization of young people today throughout Europe and the U.S.
Because though we're talking about the presidential candidates, Senator Clinton and Donald Trump, what has really been exciting watching what is going on from afar in the United States has been these huge mobilizations of young people in favor of a candidate who talks of socialism. And what I want to tell you is that this movement of young people, which has brought many more people together than one could have imagined, much larger than any political campaign I remember, involving trying to go for it against the mainstream, than at any other time in recent American history. The Vietnam, anti-Vietnam War movement didn't create a political side to it, even though Martin Luther King was talking of running as an alternative president. Not inside the Democratic Party, but together with Dr. Spock challenging the Democratic Party. That didn't happen. One reason it didn't happen is he was killed. So what we are witnessing is a very interesting radicalization, and it's a radicalization of young people which is happening in most countries in Europe today. Why? Since the 2008 Wall Street crash, many people felt, especially those who had absolutely no idea or no alternative view, that somehow the governors of the world, the rulers of this world, capitalist world, would manage to put something new in place that would give some comfort to the poor and to the young, who suffer even more on many levels. Lack of housing, too much to pay for education, and increasingly in some parts of Europe, health as well. Though we have national health services, they are under very heavy fire and attack from American health corporations, who are increasingly being given contracts by state-owned health services as part of the neoliberal system. So in this situation, it was felt that if the elites who rule the world were a bit more rational, they would attempt to put in place something different, something that had been tried before. It didn't happen. And after a short wait, you had the emergence of new popular movements from the left, and you had the emergence of mass movements from the right. This process began in different ways in different countries, but we can now see a pattern, as we can see in the United States too. And this pattern is as follows. You have had, the only country where you don't have a far-right movement is Spain, because the left have been very dominant in Spanish society, in Spanish political culture, but the conservative party in that country, the so-called popular party, has been moving further and further to the right itself. And all these movements had one thing in common. They developed from the grassroots. They developed often in one part of the country, either a region, Sicily in the case of the Five Star Movement, Madrid in the case of the occupation of the squares in Spain, and then spread rapidly from there to the rest of the country. We've been witnessing now, even as I speak, the rise of a new popular movement in France, again a movement which pushes all the established political parties to one side and says, we don't trust you. Or the intellectuals who serve these parties, we don't trust you. Keep away, move away. And we want to unite with trade unions to fight against the new laws that the French socialist government, so-called, is bringing and putting onto the statute book to restrict labor rights in France. And this movement comes together at night. Some of them work during the day. Others think it's a nice time to do it, to occupy the night. La nuit debout, the night rising. And they meet, and increasingly this movement, which started in Paris, is spreading and has spread to other parts of France. There have been clashes with the riot police, etc., etc. In Britain, the radicalization took a different form. Much to everyone's surprise, something odd happened. And what happened was that in order to reduce the power of the trade unions and the labor movement inside the Labor Party, the labor right was pushing for a virtual primary system, but different, that anyone who was a labor supporter and paid £3 could join the Labor Party and participate in the election for the leadership of this party. That's how it happened. They assumed that, like in France, this would benefit the right, because people on the right generally assume that most people are like them. In Britain, this turned out not to be the case. Once this rule came into effect, and one of the candidates was Jeremy Corbyn, a long-time socialist, a long-time supporter of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, a long-time campaigner against the wars in the Middle East, a long-time defender of Palestinian rights, who had said for decades that the Trident nuclear missiles in Britain should be got rid of. He said all this in his campaigning for the Labour Party leadership. And this, they had to broadcast this on television. Unlike here, they couldn't pick and choose, because if the other candidates were on, he had to be on. And lots of young people who hadn't heard these things before, never heard of them. And he said that one of the things he would do if he was elected a leader of the Labour Party would be to renationalize the railway networks, would be to end privatization of education, and would be to end all fees that students have been forced to pay for higher education. Within weeks, 200,000 people had paid their £3 and joined the Labour Party. I didn't do it out of principle. Many of my friends did. And they voted, to the astonishment of the media, which had been denouncing him as a crazy, as a loony, as a nut, who, you know, living in a different world, a dinosaur. Well, he got elected leader of the Labour Party. And that has now created huge problems within the Labour Party and between Corbyn and the establishment. This is in Britain, the so-called motherland of democracy, that a senior military general, serving general, gave an interview to the Sunday Times, one of Rupert Murdoch's papers, saying that if Corbyn was elected Prime Minister of England, there would be mutinies in the army and they would refuse to obey orders. That happened. Another general appeared on a breakfast time television show saying that the decision not to ditch the Trident nuclear missiles was unacceptable, would weaken Britain's defenses, and Corbyn was not suitable as a prime minister. So when a conservative grandee was asked, what the hell is going on? Can't you control the army? This is unheard of in Britain. He said, oh, well, technically, you know, of course, the Queen is the commander-in-chief of the army. So I wrote at the time, that's fine then. We all want to live under a banana monarchy. Because that's what they're saying. So the campaign against Corbyn has been huge, and so far, things have been proceeding not too badly. Attempts to force him to retreat on Trident have failed. Attempts to force him to retreat on other things have so far failed, and his popularity is slowly growing. And attempts to remove him as leader of the Labour Party, opinion poll after opinion poll shows if they did that and he stood again, he would get larger majorities as leader. Now, in Spain, a mass popular movement, Podemos, organized itself as a loose party, a party movement, a movement party, not a traditional party, and came within 2 percentage points of defeating the traditional right-wing socialist party in that country. I say this very carefully and cautiously, simply to register that there is anger on the streets and in people's homes, and this is the way they respond. This is the way this generation is responding. Corbyn in Britain, Sanders here, movements challenging social democracy there. What are their demands, effectively, if one is totally frank? What these people are demanding from the rulers and from the bankers who run this world is a little bit of social democracy. Not too much, they're saying we won't ask for too much, but we do want a health system that is not privatized, we do want free education, we want cheap homes, and we want our railways taken back, we don't want all the utilities being privatized. In Ireland, there was a huge struggle against water privatization. So, in these movements, by demanding little, they are attracting huge numbers of people. And the question then comes, is the capitalist state in these countries prepared to accept a government elected on the basis of these demands? The indications are not good, because what we are witnessing effectively is a hollowing out of the democratic process itself, that they don't care anymore. They don't need to prove that they are Democrats to anyone. Gone are the days of the Cold War when the idea of giving more space to dissidents in the media was necessary to show the communist world, look, we are better than you. That's all gone. They don't need to prove it. And they feel they can do what they want. And when there's resistance, they try, their initial reaction is to try and crush it ideologically, saying you are Putin's agents, or you're working for terrorism, or you're doing this, or you're in the grip of Islam. By the way, the country in Europe which is the most Islamophobic, much more so than the US, is France. Horrific, absolutely horrific. Islamophobia is has infected a large chunk of their intellectuals.
You're listening to writer, journalist, and filmmaker Tariq Ali at the Left Forum in New York City.
When the kids in the banlieues, the suburbs, struggle, very few white organizations off the left come in support of them. You can name 3, 4, 4 intellectuals who defend them. So Islamophobia is huge. I was in France before I came here. And whenever I was interviewed, the shock and horror when they said, once at a public event, not unlike this, about 5 or 6 people said, and you now have a Muslim mayor in London? I said, I know, France is in a state of shock. But we're in a state of shock because he's a very right-wing mayor. He completely defends corporate interests. He is completely opposed to what Jeremy Corbyn stands for. And he is cozying up to those who attacked him, the Conservatives. So it's big for you that we have a Muslim mayor, but we judge him not by his skin color or his religion, but by his politics and by what he's going to do. That is our definition. Because, you know, this is not a big deal in Britain. Lots of members of parliament, not lots, but a fair amount, are Muslims of Muslim origin. A conservative member of the government, cabinet, the business secretary, no less, is of Muslim origin. The former chairperson of the Conservative Party, who resigned as chairperson, Baroness Worsi, is a Muslim, and they come, like the new mayor, from humble backgrounds. You know, their fathers were first-generation migrants. So it's a huge mistake to fall into the trap of thinking that automatically identity is, the politics of identity are progressive. Sometimes they are, as obviously in Black Lives Matter. It's a huge movement and a very welcome movement and a movement which is broken with all the opportunist black politicians who hung on the coattails of Democrat politicians. That's the most important thing about Black Lives Matter. But the case of Asian politicians in Europe is very different, very different. So each has to be judged according to their politics and what they do when they come to power. I just want to speak briefly about the state of the Middle East. You know, this is a part of the world that was made into what it is after the First World War, when the British and French armies went in and created these small states. Prior to this, the Middle East was one area, the Arab world, and dominated by large cities, under the rule of the Ottomans, a very loose form of rule, by the way, so that you could go to school in Amman, in Jordan, you could go to a better school, secondary school in Jerusalem, and you could get your university degree in Cairo or Damascus. That's how that world used to function. Then came the First World War, and the division of the Middle East, the Arab East, into little states. And British civil servants, imperial civil servants, used to boast when asked, how did you draw the borders of Iraq? And Gertrude Bell, the civil servant in question, she said, with a stick in the sand. That's how we did it. Now we are witnessing a new imperial process carried out by this empire, whose citizens you all are, of re-dividing the Middle East and even a more reactionary fashion. The invasion of Iraq, what did it effectively do? By destroying the previous state completely, something they didn't do in Japan after the Second World War, something they didn't do in Italy after the Second World War, where 60 to 70% of fascist personnel in the armed forces, the police, the judiciary were retained, that they didn't even do fully in Germany, in West Germany. 20 to 30% of the previous personnel, including the chiefs of the intelligence services of the Third Reich, were retained by the United States to fight the new Cold War. But Iraq, completely different. Destroy every single remnant of the old state. Hand over power to Shiite clerical parties. And the result has been a disaster. A disaster. Nearly 2 million people killed during the occupation of Iraq. 5 million orphans. millions of refugees in neighboring countries. And the war in Iraq, which we were told was over, now more troops are being sent in to fight ISIS, which was created by the first war in the first place, has gone on longer than the First World War, longer than the Second World War. The wars in Afghanistan have gone on longer than the last Vietnam Wars and longer than the First and Second World Wars. And you know, when a country is occupied, however it's occupied, it has a deeply damaging effect on the psyche of all its people, regardless of which religious faction they come from. And this is now what is happening. Very few people think that Iraq can survive as a state. Northern Iraq, the Kurdish areas, are already an American-Israeli protectorate and function as such. The Iranians control Shiite Iraq. The Saudis, through ISIS, are trying to control another part of Iraq. So the old Iraq that remained united, for good or for bad, since the First World War, is about to be divided again. Syria, virtually the same thing is going on there. Because it is in the interests of the empire and its close allies in the region, Saudi Arabia and Israel, to divide them into little tiny statelets which can be controlled from outside. Hence, the destruction of the Iraqi army was considered vital. It was one of the last sovereign states. Hence the destruction of Syria, regardless of the absurdities or even crimes of their rulers, has to be destroyed to destroy any states which have sovereignty. That is not permitted in this day and age. Afghanistan is a complete and utter mess. And as some of us argued when they first went in, this war is going to go into Pakistan, and it has done, wrecking the social fabric of that country. And the drone attacks don't help. You know, there was a remarkable situation some years ago when the Iranian government, which was then considered a top-level enemy government, a policeman fighting against demonstrators, which was of course wrong, accidentally killed a young girl. Everyone admits it wasn't deliberate, as happens here all the time. It was an accident. Obama emerged in the White House lawn trying to squeeze out a tear. The American press went absolutely crazy. And the headlines, and that very same day in Pakistan, a drone attack had killed 56 women and children when they targeted a school by mistake. Not a mention in most Western newspapers. And it is these double standards that drive people mad and crazy, and they want revenge. It's not too difficult to understand why many young Muslims are going in this direction. To be frank, I'm surprised that there are not more. One should be pleased there are not more. Because given the extent of the provocation, this is what they want to do. Take revenge, saying, why can they get away with killing us? Why shouldn't we do the same? And of course, one argues sometimes against this when I'm confronted with it. But you know, you people are, you know, you don't know how to fight, etc., etc. They say that. So, in such a situation, what are we going to do? Well, in the United States, of course, those of you who live here know better than me. But again, watching it from afar, I think the model which Medea has outlined, local strength, building local grassroots, I would add to that building political bases locally and on a statewide level before expending our energies on a national campaign. That's what the left is capable of doing. The Seattle example is a very good one. When an excellent campaign by a socialist Shama Sawant has resulted in her winning at the elections again to the council, despite heavy Democratic action against her and the Democrats trying to find a candidate of color, etc. They won. It's a good model. And one shouldn't sit back, one shouldn't sit back and do nothing and wait. And that is the encouraging thing. I have to be honest with you, when I read some opinion poll which said that 30% of those who've been supporting Bernie have said that they will not under any circumstances vote for Hillary Clinton. I think that's positive. We live in a very strange world, a world of transition in which the system that is in place is not working. Everyone knows it's not working. We know it's not working, and those who run the system know it's not working. Because were it working even a tiny bit, then all these jokers in Wall Street, the bankers who stole money, half of them would be in prison for what they did. That's what happened in a tiny little place called Iceland. You heard of Iceland? They locked up most of the bankers involved in deals like this and said, you go to prison for stealing from your own people. That's what happened. But in the countries, the large countries, none of this has taken place. And while on the subject of crime and punishment, who has been punished for the war in Iraq? No one. I mean, at the very least, the United States should offer one person to be tried at the criminal court. And that could be Dick Cheney. He'd be a popular choice as war criminal. So laws that supposedly apply to others do not apply to the United States or its allies. And we're in a situation where it's become virtually impossible for mainstream parties and even some left groups and left parties. Only the Italian parties are saying withdrawal from NATO. We don't want to be part of a military alliance. The Labour Party in Britain isn't, not even Corbyn. Podemos isn't saying we should quit NATO. So there are lots of problems, but this transition also offers solutions. And these solutions are in flux at the moment. There are left futures ahead. We see them, you know, in small ways in different parts of the world, though there have been defeats here and there. But I think that we are also on the eve of change in some shape or form, because the only other choice that exists is that of the extreme right, which is much, much stronger than us all over Western Europe and North America, particularly in this country. So we have to do something, we have to organize, we have to fight back, and on every possible level.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum with journalist, author, and filmmaker Terry Galley, recorded in New York City on May 20th, 2016. Rebellion, Organizing Our Power, was the theme of this year's Left Forum. Notes from the Left Forum was produced at WBAI News in New York by Linda Perry, with thanks to Brian Drolet at Deep Dish TV and Seth Adler and Associates at the Left Forum. Thanks for listening.